This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
You're listening to Shortwave from NPR. One of the biggest challenges in archaeology is knowing where to start digging.
I mean, there are tens of millions of square kilometers of earth to explore. And
Sarah Parkek is one of the pioneers in a new field of study, trying to solve that challenge.
So I tell people it's kind of like super fancy Google Earth.
It's called space archaeology, although it's kind of more like archaeology from space.
If you think of, say, like a Roman villa somewhere in England, and it's beneath a field, and you just have the foundations of the villa left, so bits of stone.
You can't see those bits of stone from above the ground, but you can see the plants growing there.
Well, the crops or the plants that are growing on top of the foundations are going to have stunted growth because the roots are going down and they're hitting stone.
So maybe the plant life would be a little shorter or a little weaker over that stone. Subtle changes like that would be hard to spot, unless you had a good view. This exact scenario played out in the summer of 2018.
When there was, you know, so much of England that was experiencing drought.
Parts of Europe baked in out of the ordinary warm spells this summer. But
there were just hundreds and hundreds of archaeological features that popped up all over the landscape because it was so dry.
Ghostly outlines of a civilization past emerging from the moisture-starved landscape.
Those outlines are called crop marks. And in the UK in the summer of 2018, they were all over the place.
All these, you know, medieval churches and Iron Age hill forts and things that archaeologists didn't even know about showed up.
That's because of the technology space archaeologists have that can spot subtle changes in plant life, elevation, even the temperature below ground, all using drones or planes in the air and satellites in space.
So right now, basically you can zoom in from 400 miles in space and see something the size of an iPad.
What a time to be alive.
I know, right? Isn't that amazing?
This episode, Sarah Parkek on the rapidly evolving field of space archaeology and what it's helping scientists uncover about our past. I'm Maddie Sofia, and this is Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org. This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC.
Okay, so first off, Sarah Parkek is kind of a big deal. She's helped uncover prehistoric hominid fossils in eroded Kenyan lake beds, an ancient amphitheater under an airport in Rome, and in Egypt, which is her specialty, she's uncovered thousands of settlements, including more than a dozen pyramids. Are you tired?
Perpetually, but it's okay.
She's written about those discoveries, by the way, in a recent book called Archaeology from Space. And yes, Sarah does go to sites and do some real-deal digging in the dirt, archaeological excavation, but her superpower is analyzing satellite imagery and data to know where to dig in the first place.
Most of the imagery I use is called optical, satellite imagery. So it's data essentially taken from light that's reflected off the Earth's surface, and mm-hmm. we're looking for changes in patterns. We're looking for how things relate to one another, and hopefully that will indicate where there could potentially be archaeological sites or features within sites, and then we get to go out on the ground and do survey and mapping and excavate them.
When you say you use satellite images, what are we talking about? Where do those images come from, and kind of how do you manipulate them?
So it's a range of different satellite images. So if we're interested in looking at really, really large landscapes, we use data from NASA. But if we're looking at very high-resolution satellite images, we use essentially the imagery that you see on Google Earth, which is from a company called Maxar Technologies. The challenge with that data is that we can't see through trees. So if you're dealing with the rainforest of Central America or Southeast Asia or forests, say, in New England, then we use a technology called LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging. And that's a laser mapping system that you put on an airplane or a drone or a UAV, essentially allowing you to remove trees and see what's there.
In your book, you also explain how archaeologists now have the ability to detect temperature differences below the ground. Why is
that? Oh, yes.
How, first of all, cool. Second of all, how does that work? And why is that important?
So one particular part of the light spectrum that is really, really useful for the work that we do is the thermal infrared. So if you have anything that's buried and is a chamber or a void, like a room, a tomb, a buried passageway, you know, if it's kind of like when you go into a basement or a wine cellar, you know, the temperature drops a couple of degrees. So by using thermal infrared, you can see these very subtle differences in temperature. Mm-hmm. And if, say, an area shows up with a lower temperature that's the shape of a rectangle, you're like, okay, there's something that's there that we may need to check out.
Right. And it's not like you're, like, kicking archaeologists out of business, right? So it's like you still end up going in there. It just kind of helps, like, going in there and digging stuff up and looking at stuff with different techniques. But it's basically just giving you a good idea of, like, ooh, there might be something here, right?
Exactly. I mean, the coolest part of my job, I think, is the actual physical excavation, and that's so time-consuming. And so what the satellites allow us to do is not just find sites, but also track over time potential threats to them. So whether it's rising water, whether it's urbanization or development, maybe there are other issues that could be affecting the sites. What allows, it's a tool that allows archaeologists to help monitor and protect sites.
Right. And so you even kind of tried to estimate, like obviously estimating, how many more archaeological sites might be out there. And it's in like the millions, right?
Yeah, I think I estimated, and I'm probably not going to give the right number. It's the book, even though it was just a summer,
Sarah,
it was
50.
A million.
Sarah, I think it's 50. 50 million.
50, 60, 70. Do you have 70? Do you have 80? Do you have 90? So basically, I think something like 40 million, 50 million sites left to find. But, like, I could be wrong. It could be 100 million. It could be 10 million. No archaeologist yet has written me an angry email saying, how dare you? So I think, like, I think I was pretty on the mark.
Yeah. So there's another thing that I kind of wanted to talk to you, because I don't get to talk to that many archaeologists, you know what I mean? But now I've got my own show and they can't stop me, Sarah.
That's
right.
You
know what I mean? So can we talk a little bit about how colonialism and archaeology have intersected in the past, and maybe how it still does now, and what we can do about that, I guess? That's a big question for you.
If it's a big question, and it's something I and my colleagues think about a lot. So first of all, you know, I have to acknowledge that archaeology, especially Egyptology, you know, it both those fields as well as anthropology, you know, they have deeply racist colonialist roots, all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, Westerners parachute in, do their projects. You know, we're essentially archaeological tourists. That will probably rankle a lot of my colleagues. I don't care. Someone needs to speak out about this. Mm-hmm. And they leave, which is appalling. You know, I pay guards year round at the site where I work at Lisht. I have very close relationships with the village. My Egyptian core staff, you know, I speak to them every single week.
Right.
And at the end of the day, it's about those relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think we all have to do a lot of hard stares in the mirror at ourselves and ask, what are we taking and what are we leaving? Are we training? Are we providing equipment and materials? What else should we be doing to create some more parity in the work that we're doing? And I'm not the only one doing this, by the way. So many of my colleagues, both in Egypt and elsewhere, are being much more intentional. But yeah, I think we have to ask a lot of hard questions.
Yeah. You talk in the book about the importance of discoveries and how a few small discoveries can impact a field more than like a headline-worthy discovery, which I really like because I think as a person who's, you know, been a part of the scientific process, it's frustrating when, you know, only the big kind of discoveries get credit for changing fields when in reality it is those little findings. You know what I mean?
So yeah, I'll give you an example. A colleague and friend of mine, Afifi Rohim Afifi, is currently leading excavations in an area near the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. And he and his team just uncovered a new workman's village. So it's a place where men would have stayed and lived as they were constructing tombs in the Valley of the Kings. Mm-hmm. And kind of compared to other discoveries, not just in Egypt, but elsewhere, it really didn't get much play. But I think it's one of the most extraordinary discoveries in Egypt in the last 20 years. We only know of one other workman's village on the West Bank in Luxor. It's an unbelievable find because it's going to tell us about the daily life of the people who lived and worked, you know, 3,300, 3,500 years ago.
Right.
And to me, it's those discoveries that are most interesting.
All right, Sarah Parkak, we appreciate you. This was a lot of fun.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Go to bed.
I will go to bed.
Take a nap.
Thank you.
Thanks to Sarah Parkak. You can read about her work in her book, which is called Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. This episode was produced by Brent Bachman, edited by Viet Le, and fact-checked by Emily Vaughn. I'm Maddie Sofia. Thanks for listening to Shortwave from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Indeed. When it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/shortwave. Terms and conditions apply. This message comes from NPR sponsor VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center, who, as an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center in the country's top 4%, is unconditionally committed to keeping loved ones in their lives. MasseyCancerCenter.org/comprehensive.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little bricks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.